Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. Our first speaker series event of 2014 is coming up, I believe, on February 11th, Tuesday, February 11th. Those tickets sell out pretty quickly, so you're going to want to go on the website and check that out. I'm your other guest host, Marie Stone. We're doing sort of a tag team approach today. Let's get onward with the show. I'm joined now by Gina Frangello. Gina is the co-founder of Other Voices Books and the editor of the fiction section of The Nervous Breakdown, as well as the Sunday editor of The Rumpus. She's the author of one previous novel, My Sister's Continent, and one collection of short stories, Slut Lullabies. Her latest novel, A Life in Men, is the subject of our chat this morning. It's published by Algonquin, and it's my pleasure to welcome her this morning. Gina, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
I should say welcome back, because we were together a couple of years ago.
Yes.
So I will let you start talking about A Life in Men and sort of the inspiration for it, the scope of it, and, introduce us to your world.
Well, the novel spans 13 years, and it takes place in 9 different countries, so it has a fairly wide scope and many different inspirations. At the heart of the novel is a woman named Mary who has cystic fibrosis, and that part was definitely inspired by a woman I lived with in college who had cystic fibrosis and was an avid traveler despite her physical struggles, which was just something that stayed with me for many years, even after she had passed away. But the novel is also greatly inspired by place. It takes place partially in Morocco, in Mexico, in Amsterdam, in London, all places that I have either lived or spent a great deal of time, sometimes even in the actual buildings, houses that I used to live in. It spans a long period of time, both in the fictional reality of Mary and the other characters, but also of my life in places that kind of formed me.
It sounds like, in a lot of ways, it's one of the more personal books you've written, given kind of the characters that are drawn from life, the places that are drawn from life. And I don't know how true that was of Slut Lullabies or My Sister's Continent, but I was curious if you could talk a little bit about drawing from life versus drawing from imagination and, if one's a little more difficult than the other, or what the limitations are.
Yes, certainly. My Sister's Continent is a novel that was inspired by Freud's Dora case. So it was very much, it was not an autobiographical novel on that sort of plot level. The plot paralleled and sort of, dipped and curved from basic things that had been in that original Freud case study. And so that was a very different type of, it was a different type of writing. It was really personal. The characters still often were, emotionally, I think we always write emotional autobiography to some extent. But on a plot level, that one really was somewhat dictated by certain parameters that already existed historically or in literature and psychoanalysis. My short stories have been definitely much more, they're across the board. Some are strictly fictional and others are very, very based on things that have happened in real life or characters, people who I've known. But this one definitely felt like, in strange ways, the most personal novel that I've written, even though I don't have cystic fibrosis, and so it also required strangely more research and kind of trying to become well-versed with and familiar with something that was really outside of my experience bodily. Emotionally, I feel like this is definitely the most autobiographical work that I've written, just in terms of the way place inspires us and changes us and the many people we are over the course of a lifetime and the different ways intimacy manifests.
Right, right. And I read that in the aftermath of this, you had a personal friend who passed away.
Yes.
The book has sort of become some sort of template or healing way for you to deal with this loss of a friend in the aftermath, much like the, sort of like life imitating art.
Yes, yes. I have an essay at the end of the book, which is actually, yes, called Life Imitates Art. Yeah. And my friend Kathy, who I had been extremely close with since we were 16 years old, and I'm an only child, and she was like a sister to me. She died very suddenly. She was diagnosed with ovarian cancer basically a month after A Life in Men sold to Algonquin, and she was dead within 4 months. And it was a very strange thing, because really at the center of the novel is how we cope with loss and grief. Mary loses her best friend very early in the book, and she was, you know, she thought she was the one who was terminally ill. She was the one who was going to die young, and instead she loses someone. And really, her friend Nix's presence kind of haunts her throughout the rest of the novel. She writes a lot of letters to her. She keeps journals about her. And so it was very strange. I mean, I found myself doing some of the same kinds of things that Mary does. I found myself speaking aloud to Kathy on streets late at night when I was walking, you know, just, and it was very, it was disconcerting and yet comforting at the same time. Nothing about that was an inspiration for writing the book, because Kathy was alive and healthy when the book was being written, but it ended up really speaking a lot to what I ended up going through.
Right. Right. My guest this morning is Gina Frangello. The book, A Life in Men. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm hardly unique in observing this, but you're often asked, and rightly so, how writing sex and intimacy comes so easily to you. And I wonder if we should also ask the corollary question of why it's so difficult for most. It just seems like people dread writing sex scenes.
It's so true. I mean, I don't get that, because, I started writing very young, and of course I wasn't writing about sex, obviously. I was a kid, but I mean, from my first college writing workshop when I was about 19, my stories have tended to have kind of a sexual psychology to them, and it's just always been something I've been drawn to as a mode of character exploration. I mean, I feel like other than eating and sleeping, I mean, it's sort of one of the few things that really is universal human experience, and yet that at the same point reveals so much that's quirky and individual about people, and reveals so much about just sort of how they process the world and how they interact with other people in terms of power dynamics, in terms of, you know, past demons or shells they put around themselves. So I've always been really drawn to it. I was asked this last night on the Rumpus Book Club chat, because I have been their book club selection, and I just said, you know, I think it's hard for people when they don't like to do it. I've not found writing about sex hard. I don't mean don't like to do sex. I mean don't like to write about it. You know, I've always liked it. It has not been difficult for me. It's always been something that I've just, you know, naturally gravitated towards as a way of getting to know my characters and who they are to each other and to themselves in the world.
Right, right. I think people are put off by either body parts or, I don't know what it, you know, it sounds cheesy or cliche.
You know, one limitation I think is that I think people sometimes think they need to make their sex sexy. And I think that if you go into writing about sex thinking that you need to titillate the reader, you would definitely be crippled. Because most of the most interesting sex in literature isn't necessarily turn on sex. You know, it's not the same as writing erotica. Often it's awkward, often it's upsetting, often it's just revealing, you know, and so, you know, I don't go at it with an idea that the reader should be turned on by the experience of reading it, or that I should feel that way as the writer. And so I think maybe people put those sort of expectations on themselves, and if you do, it's very easy then to feel cheesy.
That is a great point. I haven't heard it talked about that way, but that is a great point. I think that's exactly, I think that's exactly the limitation, that people are like, well, I can't write porn.
Right.
The task.
It's really psychology. It's not, I mean, often I write a lot about sex with very little mention of actually what goes where.
Right, right. And you do it so well.
Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about trust, both trust as a writer and trust in the work, and when you know to let something go, because I heard there's one character in here who comes from a novel that hasn't been published of yours,
yes.
And that this
yes.
book was sort of put away for a while and then came back out. When mm-hmm. do you know when a book, when a work has legs and when it should just remain on your hard drive?
Well, it's really difficult to know that. I mean, I think we have very different opinions about that in hindsight than we do at the moment. The book London Calling, where Yank, the character of Kenneth, whose nickname is Yank, first appeared, was my graduate school novel. I wrote it in the late 90s, before My Sister's Continent even was written or published. And, you know, he's not a minor character, but he's not a point of view character as he is in A Life in Men, but he's someone who really stayed with me. And, you know, he just sort of materialized in this book, which begins, he appears in A Life in Men about a year after the action of London Calling, the other novel. London Calling at one point had a publisher, Impetus Press, which went bankrupt right before the book went to press. So the book would be out in the world, but now I'm sometimes kind of glad it isn't. Now that I have three books written later that are out, it seems like a much younger book to me. It seems like a place I was at much earlier in my, you know, in my development as a writer, really different from my work now. So, you know, I'm sort of happy with him just living there as an inspiration and not necessarily having to be out in the world.
Right, right. Oh, you know, all of these characters are so great. I was wondering if there were some that gave you more trouble and how you mine these people, especially the people that are so different from you, but how you get inside their skin and if there are some of them that prove more challenging to get in their skin than others.
That's certainly always true. A Life in Men has a lot of point of view characters. It has a roving, editorial, omniscient kind of point of view. And it's interesting because, you know, I mean, I think on the surface the book is about two fairly young women and might appear for that reason to, like, appeal to that demographic of reader. But in reality, most of the point of view characters, other than Mary and Nix, are male and really kind of span age groups, nationalities, you know, experiences. So, yeah, I mean, Yank is, you know, a middle-aged ex-junkie photographer from Atlanta. And, you know, Husnain is a British Muslim young man at one point in the story and, you know, pushing 40 by the end. And there are a lot of them like that who just, you know, are from all over the place and are coming at things from very different angles. And I definitely, you know, they were mostly, I knew them pretty well before I started writing about them because I think about my characters for a long time before they get on the page. Like, they kind of start talking to me where I'm almost taking dictation. But I will say that it took a long time for Husnain to come to me. I wrote the last section probably 2 months after finishing the rest of the draft of the novel. I just was waiting to hear him more. And it took longer. His background is definitely more different from mine. And then when he came, that chapter was written pretty much all in one sitting.
Would you say this was mostly character-driven versus plot-driven, place-driven? Was it the characters who led you to the places or vice versa?
Well, my first image ever for the novel was the one of Kenneth and Sonder embracing in the corridor outside of Mary's hospital room in Morocco and saying goodbye to one another. And that happens very near the end of the book, and it was the first thing I thought of for the book. And I kind of knew that I was writing to that place, that somehow they were getting to Morocco and this assemblage of characters was going to end up there, but I didn't know what was going to happen to get them there. Definitely, you know, I don't think I've really ever written anything that was particularly plot-driven. This was more driven by place than other things I've written, but character is always really at the core. If I'm not pretty much obsessed with a character, I don't have much interest in writing it.
Right. Did this change very much from first draft to completion?
Yes. Not that one chapter, actually, Plain People, that I wrote really quickly, but later than the rest of the book, changed very little, almost not at all. But the other parts of the novel were basically about a 3.5-year process. I mean, I wrote a first draft. I even had an agent who had started shopping it. And then I went to Kenya for a month and came back completely determined to rewrite the entire book, which I did in only a couple of months after it having taken 3 years to get a first draft. And I started kind of all over again. I added the Kenya chapter. I took out a bunch of things that had happened in Bogota. I completely changed the Canary Islands. Like, it just changed a great deal. I ended up with a new agent, and then it went out and sold about a month later.
Unbelievable. Wow. My guest this morning is Gina Frangello. That's lovely. The book is A Life in Men. I want to turn to some crafty questions, but before we do that, maybe you could just read to us for a minute to let our listeners know what this book sounds like.
Sure. Hold on 1 second.
Sorry about that. Sprung it on you.
Fine. No, that's all right. I wander around my house when I'm talking, so I just have to get the book in my hand. Here it is. All right, so I'm going to read just a little bit that takes place. The Greece sections are broken up throughout the novel, but they take place all in about a 24-hour period of time. And in this, Mary and Nyx have found themselves at a deserted beach with two men that they've just had an altercation with, an argument, and they've insisted on going home back to their hotel. And they're in the car with a man named Zorik. Mary sits up front, impervious as a queen. In the back seat, like a naughty child who has eaten and drunk too much, Nyx reclines, head resting in the crook of her arm. The treacherous curves around tightly wound cliff roads feel like bed spins. Zorik is driving too fast. In the scenario they no doubt all envisioned, there would have been hours at the beach still for the three bottles of consumed wine to wear off. Instead, Zorik is pink in the face from climbing all the way down to the beach to retrieve their things, just to turn around and climb back up to the car, at the insistence of Nyx, who has claimed a killer headache. Only now, as she grows dizzy from the car's lurching, has it occurred to Nyx that it might not be the best idea to drive some of Greece's most hairpin turns with a drunken, pissed-off man at the wheel. Well, okay. To be honest, she and Mary drank most of the wine. They are good for that, even at home. Not just the Ass sisters, but the Lush sisters, too. Probably Zorik, who weighs almost as much as she and Mary combined, is not even that drunk. No doubt it will occur to him at any moment that he should slow down. He is an airline pilot, after all. Nyx closes her eyes, tries to sleep. But no. Instead of settling into the rhythm of the road, Zorik seems only to be accelerating. When Nyx sits up, she sees that his jaw is set, the muscles in his right thigh twitching, his broad hands clutching the wheel. The car rims the curves of the road like a darting tongue, teasing. Somewhere below, the restaurants, discos, hotels of Mykonos wait nestled at sea level, the rest of the island straining upward. They are caught in an elevated web of cliffs. A lump rises in Nyx's esophagus, signaling danger. Beneath her legs, the car seat trembles, unsteady. She pitches to the other side of the car at each turn, clings tightly to the door handle to keep herself still, as if clutching the rails of a roller coaster. Her hands are slick with sweat. She thinks of having to powder them before gripping at the parallel bars, and even though she is not on a gymnastics team at Skidmore, has not done gymnastics since leaving Kettering more than 2 years ago, she is gripped by a terror that she will never touch a parallel bar again, a fear that this seat is the last thing she will ever hold on to before they plunge off a cliff to certain death below. She cannot imagine, oh, but yes, she finds she can imagine it, the weightlessness before her body begins to fly upward against the car's roof, the pitching in her stomach so that she might vomit before she hits earth. It is in our DNA to be able to feel such scenarios in our bodies, like archetypes of fear, possible ways the human body can meet its end, with scraps of yellow hair, white and red flesh, torn to bits by the very teeth of the jagged cliffs she'd mused on earlier in her foolish drunken rhapsody. Should I stop there?
Look at how sexual your writing is, even when you're not writing about sex.
That's funny.
Every sentence I was like, well, that's sensual. Well, that's sensual. That was Gina Frangello.
Thanks, I guess.
That's your special gift, Gina. That's unbelievable. That was Gina Frangello reading from A Life in Men. That was fantastic. So I want to talk a little bit about the blessing of being busy. I'm going to shame myself and my listeners here by announcing that in addition to everything else you do, you have three kids. You know, you work for The Nervous Breakdown, you work for The Rumpus, you teach, you edit, you obviously write. And somehow you sandwich, you know, novels into the center of all of this. And I'm wondering if there is some blessing to being busy, if there is some blessing to not having, you know, a room of one's own.
Well, I literally do not have a room of one's own. I have a little office that doesn't have a door that is right off my living room where my kids are constantly congregating with like 97 friends and a blaring television or whatever, you know. So yeah, I don't have a lot of space and I am extremely busy, and it's interesting. You know, I grew up, I'm an only child, and I grew up in a very quiet house. You know, my parents were older. We lived in a really small place, so I'm used to not having much space. You know, I grew up very inner city, but you know, I had a lot of privacy as a child, and I wrote a great deal. I started writing when I was really young. I had written my first quote unquote novel by the time I was about 11, and you know, so it's bit of big adjustment, but I find that for some reason, I mean, I have a lot of difficulty turning my mind off, and so for me, having a lot going on is kind of imperative. I need to be spinning a lot of plates. I work better when I actually have a lot of time. The worst writing summer of my life was the summer that I went to New Mexico when I was maybe, I don't know, 24 years old or so. My then fiance, now husband, was working in Los Alamos, and we went out there, and I had nothing to do. I didn't know a soul in Santa Fe, and I wasn't working, and it was going to be sort of this writerly retreat for me, and I was going to just work all summer and write the first draft of a novel. And I was really sick. I had hideous high altitude asthma, but I have never written so little in a summer in my life. Summer is a big writing time for me. And, you know, that equation just doesn't really work for me as an adult, having nothing else to do. I write better kind of like on the fly.
Right, right. Does writing beget writing? As you're writing this, does it stimulate the next project, or does the next project really come out of nowhere else?
Sometimes I know what the next project will be, but I have a long refractory period between pieces. I think that's probably good, because I need to, you know, kind of catch up after I've written a novel. I get really insane at the end of a book. I get very manic. I can't do anything else except for write. I kind of isolate from friends. I don't do other work. You know, I'm like figuratively calling in sick on everything else. And so, you know, I usually have a lot of mad catch-up to do and just sort of like plunging myself back into the universe after I'm done with a novel. But, you know, it'll take a while. Sometimes I don't write any new fiction for about 9 months, which is something that I think, you know, you have to learn how to sit with that. Like, you have to learn that you're not the writer who just gets up at 4 a.m. and writes for 2 hours before everyone wakes up every day, and that eventually that adds up to a novel. Like, there are people who work that way. And then, you know, sometimes I'm just focusing on my editing and my teaching and my living a life, and I'm not writing anything. And, you know, I have to trust. I mean, I'm 45, and so by now I do trust, but it was hard at first, that it will come back.
Right, right. Speaking of writing and editing and teaching, actually, I was wondering if there are kind of common mistakes and pitfalls you've seen over the course of your career now that writers make that you could, you know, talk us out of.
Well, certainly. I think that editing Other Voices magazine, which I did, you know, from, I guess, 1998 until about 2007, so I mean that was a long period of time, you know, definitely taught me a great deal about things that I wanted to avoid in my own fiction. I mean, probably the punchline ending is the example that I give most often to students, you know, where it's just kind of like, you're going to reveal something, some trick, some, you know, some punchline at the end of your story, and, you know, it seems so clever. You're like, wow, this is going to blow everyone's mind. And, like, but when everything is focused on that one thing, then what happens 95% of the time or more is that, you know, once you know the punchline, you never need to read that piece again, and everything about that piece just becomes the end. Mm-hmm. And that I feel like, you know, any work of fiction, it's a process, and it should yield new results every time you read it. It should, like, keep opening itself up to you and be able to stand up over more than one reading. So, I mean, I say avoid the punchline ending, definitely. But, you know, there are a lot of different things that people do, certainly, that, you know, that I've tried to stay away from. I mean, sometimes it's just a matter of, like, not following the trends. I mean, like, I remember I was editing when Bastard Out of Carolina became popular, and it was suddenly, like, everything I was reading was, you know, an abused girl in the South, you know. And people just will read something, and they'll kind of fall in love with it, and that'll become, you know, the trendy thing to write. And so just kind of being more true to people's own, you know, their own visions, or you know, that old adage of writing what you know, not necessarily it being autobiographical, but what's important to you, not just what you think will sell or what's marketable.
Right, right. That's how we've ended up with all these vampire and zombie and...
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, which is a different type of writing. I mean, obviously, someone writes a zombie novel, like, you know, one of the reasons they're writing a zombie novel is because it's popular and they're aiming to sell it, and that's, you know, that's a valid career goal, you know, but, I mean, I think that's very different than, like, the type of fiction that is being driven by, like, you write it because you have to. There's an emotional imperative.
Right, right. Sadly, we've drawn... I could talk to you for a whole day, but we've drawn down on our time. How do we find you online?
Well, my website is about to actually finally, like, re-debut. It's been redesigned. So I'm at GinaFrangiello.com, and that should be up within a day or two, actually, so it's good timing. But I'm on the Rumpus every Sunday, and I'm, you know, I'm on the Nervous Breakdown. I curate the fiction section, but I write for the Nervous Breakdown as well, and I've been doing a lot of, like, guest things. The Manifestation, run by Jennifer Pasteloff, has an excerpt of A Life in Men on it right now. So I'm definitely online.
You're out there. Gina Frangiello, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk to you again.
It was fun. That was Gina Frangiello. The book is A Life in Men. It's out and available now, and an incredibly great read. That's all the time we have for today. I will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next week, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.